to continue some of the Yankee conversation, we bring in longtime columnist for the New York Post, Mike Vaccaro. Mike has written a new book. It is called The Bosses of the Bronx, The Endless Drama of the Yankees Under the House of Steinbrenner. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Lori, it's great to be here. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing just fine. We're going to get into the book and some of the details there and ownership. But before I get into that, I just was curious where, you know, had a frustrated Yankee fan before the break complaining about how the Yankees had made a miscalculation bringing back, Trent Grisham. And he takes the qualifying offer, and now that kind of, now that they've brought back Cody Bellinger, that blocks Jason Dominguez, it blocks Spencer Jones. There's no place for some of these young players who may start the year at AAA. And I don't know if you saw Brian Cashman. Jason Dominguez has gotten off to a hot start. He was asked about this on Saturday, and he made it clear: oh no, no, right now. Dominguez, there's nothing he can do to earn a starting spot on the roster right now. And so I'm just curious, when the general manager says this about a 23-year-old, he said he's, taking reps, trying to push himself in the mix. The quote was from Cashman, clearly the everyday spot's not there. What do you make of a comment like this, and how does it play into how the Yankees have I don't know, dealt with prospects through the years?
I understand why fans are upset, because there's nothing more magical to a fan than the unlimited ceiling that you imagine a player to have. And both those players are really good, Lori, so don't get me wrong. I mean, I understand why Yankees fans are excited. But I also understand that those are two established players they're trying to unseat. And, Bellinger is a former MVP, had a very good year last year. Obviously, Grisham had a ridiculous year last year in terms of his past performance. So I understand, because if circumstances have been different, would a budding first baseman named Lou Gehrig have ever gotten a job, or you can go on down the line, stuff like that. So I get it, but I also understand that the Yankees made commitments to those two guys, and I think until it's overwhelming evidence that the better option is to go with the other players, I understand why they want to, give the other guys as much opportunity as they can. Look, Dominguez has shown flashes of brilliance here, and also, flashes of whatever the opposite of that is. So I don't think he's anything close to as well as he's playing, he's nothing close to a short thing. And look, I get Spencer Jones. I mean, there's all kinds of things that go on in your mind about pairing him in the middle of that offense with Aaron Judge for the next 5 years, and, all the great pairings the Yankees have had. But also, a couple of weeks of terrific spring training also doesn't always project. I don't think it would be the worst thing in the world for, him specifically to maybe spend a few weeks to start the season in AAA and, hit your way back. And there's just as many stories across baseball, across the Yankees history, of guys who did that, and it worked out well for them. So, like I said, I get it. I understand the frustration of fans who want to see these guys play. I also think the Yankees are trying to maximize. I mean, the Yankees aren't trying to lose. They're trying to maximize as many games they can win. And in their estimation, that's what's going to get them the opportunity until the other players, the kids, kind of prove them wrong. And I think I understand why they would do that.
All right, you mentioned the Yankees have a history, so let's talk about the history of the Yankees and turning to the premise of your book, which is about the House of Steinbrenner, about George Steinbrenner, Hal Steinbrenner. And so let's set the stage. What were the Yankees like as a team when Steinbrenner buys them?
They were a fiasco, Lori. There's no other way to put it. I mean, they had been in the playoffs in 9 years when he bought the team in January 1973. They were in disarray. Their farm system was a mess. They played in a dilapidated stadium that was going to be renovated, but they still weren't totally committed to staying there. So they were kind of a free agent. I mean, New Orleans was trying to make a big play because they wanted the team from the Superdome. New Jersey was, and would for the next 20 years, try and see if they could figure out a way with the Yankees. And you know, things just weren't good. And CBS had owned the team for a decade, and it kind of run it into the ground. There was a lot, you know, there was a dearth of hope. The Mets had overtaken them almost 2-1 in New York, which is hard to figure. But it was that desperate for the Yankees. And, you know, Steinbrenner came in, and in the moment he was, you know, 42 years old. He was young. He was brash. He was different than CBS. And that was the first impression that people had of him. And, you know, he said that they were going to be winners in 3 years. And you know what? 3 years later, they won the American League East. They went to the World Series. And, you know, his vision of what the Yankees ought to be was already in place by then, which is, you know, we're a New York team. We're going to use the great asset that New York City is and the even better asset that the Yankees are. The interlocking NY is probably the most famous logo in the world, sports, out of sports, anywhere. And it's, you know, he understood the importance of that and the value of that, but he was also willing to make his blueprint based upon those advantages and those assets that he had with this team in this market. And he did that.
I think there's a lot of nostalgia that when you talk to Yankee fans, and certainly I sit here, and if the Yankees are ever struggling or if they're not spending on a player or something happens and people say, well, the boss wouldn't have done this or the boss would be rolling over his grave or whatever. There's a nostalgia for George Steinbrenner. If you are old enough, and I won't date you or myself, but if you're old enough to have lived through a lot of the reign of Steinbrenner, of the boss, of George Steinbrenner, and remember it, then you remember both the good and the bad. And so let's start with, what was the best of George Steinbrenner, the positives that you remember and that you cover in the book?
I think that's clearly the time that he went recruiting Reggie Jackson, realizing that was the guy he needed to target. Look, the Yankees had already signed Catfish Hunter. They'd already established the rest of baseball. They were going to do what it took to get players. They weren't necessarily always the highest bidders. But again, Steinbrenner understood that there was value in bringing somebody to New York at maybe a 5% discount and allowing them and the magic of New York to take over. And that happened for Catfish. It really, you know, obviously happened for Reggie. And, you know, that was really it. You know, Reggie has always talked about George's recruitment of him. And he said, you know, he hustled me, man. I mean, he was like, you know, it's a fair representation, you know. George brought him to New York on a recruiting trip. He didn't give him the highest offer. The highest offer for Reggie, believe it or not, came from the Expos, which isn't a team that you ever thought of would be in a bidding war with anybody. But, you know, he took him to lunch at 21, which in the moment was, you know, the only restaurant to go to. So that impressed Reggie. But then, you know, instead of taking a taxi back to his hotel or to George's apartment, he said, let's go walking for a while. And sure enough, as if he'd set it up, and you know, you can't set these things up in New York, random people just started going up to Reggie. We need you, Reggie, we need you, we need you, Reggie, we need you. And, you know, George knew enough of Reggie's ego that would be a huge selling point also. And, you know, I think that's the best of George. Look, to me, one of the reasons why he was such a fascinating subject to cover is that it wasn't all good and it wasn't all bad. There was an equal measure of both. And the, you know, the good was very good. The bad was very, very bad. You know, I think it's really curious that the two times of Yankee prosperity under George's watch, many of the players were assembled with George not in the picture because he was suspended two times. And the first time we had a guy like Gabe Paul, who, you know, in George's absence, you know, put together a team, Mickey Rivers, Ed Figueroa, Willie Randolph, Chris Chambliss, on and on. That team wound up being the bones of a champion. And later on, it was Gene Michael who, you know, the one thing he was able to do was to retain this core of four or five young players, you know, around whom the Yankees wound up winning four championships. And in some of those cases, you know, five. So, you know, it wasn't always that George had all the answers, but he was the guy who set the tone. And look, we joke about it now about, you know, the Yankees believe in either championships or misery. And he was the guy who established that, and sometimes you can lampoon that. But the fact is, that's what the Yankees became. That's what the Yankees are. He's been gone for almost 16 years, and that's still what the Yankees' goal mission is, stated mission is every year. It's just a lot different game now than it was when George was the guy who was, you know, spending the money.
I also think of credit him with the vision for the YES Network and the creation of the Yankees having their own television network. And, you know, in many ways, that's part of the financial haves and have-nots that we're seeing in baseball that may very well lead to a work stoppage, you know, in a year when the collective bargaining runs out and the players and the owners, if they can't agree on a new contract. But the vision by Steinbrenner to create the YES Network and the you know, the wealth that that brought the Yankees, he was, you know, ahead of his time with that.
He was, and, you know, that was something that predates even the YES Network by a couple of decades, because, you know, when he bought the Yankees, their TV package was nothing, their radio package was nothing. You know, it wasn't just that the Mets are outdrawing them 2-1 at the stadium, but the ratings were not even competitive. And, you know, part of that was because they had bad TV deals. You know, in the immediate aftermath of them winning a little bit, all of a sudden they were getting more money from the radio end and the TV end. And it was George who really saw the future of cable television and what it meant. You know, he put a couple of games on Sports Channel in the late 70s, early 80s. And later on in that decade is when he signed the, you know, just earth-shattering, earth-moving contract with MSG Network, which really changed the game forever. And, you know, he saw how much that the Yankees could mean in that medium. And, you know, I think those are where the seeds are planted for what became YES. And obviously it was a stroke of genius. But he saw that right away. I mean, he saw that, you know, part of the way you get the message out is by making deals with TV and radio so you can make your product available and you can make people get excited about it. And then you cash in on that, on the back end of it, you know? I mean, he got ripped for that MSG deal because it took almost all the 50 games off free TV in the moment. And, of course, you know, that's not what people want to see. But, you know, he saw where this was going, and he was right in figuring out where it was going.
Yeah, visionary, obviously, from a business standpoint, George Steinbrenner. And talking to Mike Vaccaro about the Yankees, about the Steinbrenners, and Mike's new book. So some of the positives we talked about with George, and that from a fan perspective, the just focus on winning is everything, and winning the World Series has to be the goal every year, and setting a standard and an expectation, having the highest payroll and all those things that George did, that fans loved him for that. The flip side, if those are some of the best, the flip side, some of the worst, what are some of the, for fans who maybe became a Yankee fan in more recent memory and don't go as far back, what are some of the aspects of George that represent the worst of him?
Well, he was impetuous, Lori. I mean, you know, you can just go through the string of managers and general managers he blitzed through in the 80s. And, you know, the problem for George is that, you know, he was a guy on the one hand who understood where the game had to go. You know, even if he was signing all those free agents in the 70s, Reggie and Catfish and Goose Gossage, he realized that was unsustainable. You couldn't build a champion just to last year after year, decade after decade, by just buying the best player on the market. You had to establish a farm system. You had to invest in infrastructure. And he did. He was committed to it. The problem was, as would be the case a lot of times, that George was a lot of the time overruled by the other George, which was the guy who couldn't stand the fact that the Yankees had lost 5 games in a row. And I got to replace the pitching coach. I got to, you know, trade, you know, 2 prospects for a washed up pitcher, because the pitcher right now, in my eyes, looks like the better choice. And that was the problem why the Yankees, by the time he was suspended from baseball the second time, were a mess. I mean, they were a losing team. They were a bad organization. And, you know, much of that can be attributed to the fact that, you know, George the fan didn't listen to George the businessman. And as a result, by the time he left baseball for the second time, they were a mess. But he was lucky enough to have hired, and it's not just luck. I mean, he knew how good Gene Michael was. And trusted Gene Michael, every bit the same way he knew how good Gabe Paul was when he brought him with him right at the start with the Yankees. So, you know, the problem for George was that sometimes he just wouldn't listen to the better angels of his nature, and he wound up paying dearly for that. You know, almost wound up losing the team because of it. And, you know, I think that's part of the story also.
Yeah, in a flawed and interesting person, and certainly I think there is this desire to look back and always paint a rosy picture of the boss, but, you know, yeah, a guy who was suspended twice and for good reason. So, and some of the comments and things that he said or did, all of that is part of the story. But big picture, you make the case that George should be in the Hall of Fame. Why do you believe that?
I'll tell you what, Lori, I spent years and years believing the exact opposite because, you know, to me, a guy who gets thrown out of baseball twice, you know, wasn't supposed to go to Cooperstown. He's just not. And you know, and I think over the course of time, what I've done, and I think this is one of the great things about time and history in baseball, is you get a chance to evaluate your opinions and see if you still believe that way. And the fact of the matter is, it's very simple. You can't write the history of baseball without including a large segment of the time that George Steinbrenner owned the Yankees from 1973 to 2010 when he passed. I mean, for better, for worse, for everything. I mean, this is a guy who was, you knew he was in the room. They won a lot under him. And while you necessarily don't have to credit him for all of that, certainly he put the pieces in place to where, you know, people who make those kind of decisions were allowed to make those decisions. And he was willing to float fairly high payrolls for much of his time there. But, you know, you can't, like I said, you can't write the history of baseball without him. And to me, that's part of the, it's the same way you can't write the history of baseball without mentioning, oh, by the way, you know, Pete Rose had, you know, 4,300 hits or however many he wound up with. You know, so you can make the argument for a guy like Pete Rose that way also. And I think that, look, in the same way I've always said that Rose, if he should ever get into the Hall of Fame, on his plaque should be the fact that he, you know, was caught betting on his team. And, you know, that should be part of what his legacy was in addition to all the great stuff. I think it should be the same thing with George Steinbrenner, you know. Mention the fact he was suspended twice. Mention why he was suspended twice, especially the second time, where he essentially blackmailed his best player. But also mention all the good, you know. And this is a guy who basically, you know, for his partners, showed how to make a lot of money by exploring cable TV, by exploring other revenue streams, by understanding that in order to make money and to win games, sometimes you had to hurt a little bit, and you had to actually sign guys for a little bit more than you wanted to. And that's all part of his legacy, and certainly when you consider some of the other owners and executives who were in the Hall, I think it's pretty clear that George Steinbrenner belongs there.
So real quick before I let you go, I'm sure we're shortchanging him, but maybe that's also part of it, is in what way is Hal Steinbrenner perhaps misunderstood?
Well, here's the thing, Lori, and it's a great question, because I think it's important to remember that when George, you know, put together the team in 77 that was called the best team money could buy, mm-hmm. the payroll was about $3 million, which is hilarious when you think about it. But the thing is, even if you adjust that to inflation, in 2026, that's about $23, $24 million, which is about what they're going to pay Judge by the All-Star break, right? It's a completely different plan. And, you know, in the old days, when George would make light of, you know, when his partners would ask him, I haven't had a dividend in a couple of years, you know, he'd joke and laugh and say, well, that's the cost of your season tickets. You have really good tickets. And everybody would laugh and move on, and George would do his thing. You can't do that now. You know, now you're talking about baseball players who are signing contracts for almost $750 million. And, you know, when he goes over this stuff with his partners, I mean, he's got to answer real questions. I mean, you know, for better or worse, the Steinbrenner family, while no one's going to, you know, call the telethon for them, they're not the Dodgers. They're not even the Blue Jays, frankly. I mean, owned by corporate, you know, monoliths that have endless resources. And no one's going to throw a pity party for the Yankees, and I'm not doing that here, nor am I excusing. You know, it's just that it is a different game. And the thing, and I think it only really applies when people say, well, if George was still alive. I mean, I know you get that, you know, 2,000 times a season. If George is still alive, Brian Cashman would be fired. If George is still alive, Aaron Boone would be fired. If George is still alive, on and on and on. And I get it, and I understand the sentiment. It just is not really based in reality, because George owned a different team than Hal owns. And it's just the nature of the economics of the sport. And it could be part of the reason why we're careening toward Armageddon next spring.
Or
next,
yeah.
Earlier, next fall.
Mike Vaccaro, appreciate the time. The book is called The Bosses of the Bronx, The Endless Drama of the Yankees Under the House of Steinbrenner. And Mike, anything else you want to let people know about where they can find the book?
Well, you can get it anywhere. You order it online, Amazon. You can go to HarperCollins.com. That's available now for pre-order. The book drops on March 24th.
Okay.
And that's when it will be available in bookstores everywhere. And the Post has been nice enough. They're gonna excerpt the book for a couple of days before publication. Looking forward to that. And it's an exciting time, and it's fun talking about this because, man, that was a fun time in baseball. It was a fun time in the city and a fun time with the Yankees. And that's, that's really the end of the day why we all go to baseball in the first place, right?
Yep. All right. Mike Fraccaro from the New York Post. Appreciate the time.
Boy, I really appreciate it. Thanks for talking to me. Appreciate it. Have a good night.